Our topics today, we'll get to the first one. Number one, if a life insurance policy is owned by a trust, what is the ongoing maintenance required for the strategy to succeed most effectively? Many times you ask us, what will the ongoing maintenance fees be? And we're notorious for saying there'll be none, as we say with a beaming smile, because we think that that's an important piece in the financial consideration. But there are pieces that are necessary to start up, and there are annual pieces of work that need to be done, and some of our clients say, we don't want to do it. Would you do it for us? So once the trust is created, because it's an irrevocable document, because it's a contract, we have to get a tax ID number. Number two is we need to set up a checking account, which will serve as the funding vehicle for the annual payments, or more frequently, payments made to the insurance company. So a gift is made from you into a checking account, and then the checking account is used by the trustees. It's a trust checking account to make the premium payment. In the past, we would make sure that that checking account was non-interest-bearing, and today we still try to do that as well, because if there's interest on that account, it's sad, but you have to file a tax return if the trust was not what we call a defective trust. Our life insurance trusts are defective, so the income picked up is picked up on the annual return of the grantor or the party to whom the trust is defective to. So even if the trust, even if the account is income bearing, the answer is there should be no tax return needed to be filed by the trust. Because other than that, there is no reason to file a tax return for an unfunded life insurance trust. The grantor can assist the trustee with premium payments. Those trusts are funded into the account. Why is this such a great strategy? Many years ago, the IRS said that when you make a gift into the trust, you're subject to gift tax. But we said, well, listen, we have exemptions. We can file, we have a $10,000 now, a $14,000 annual exemption. We can make gifts to individuals. And the IRS took the stand that the position that since you're making a gift into a trust, there is no one that receives what we call a present interest. It's not like giving a bike to your child or a rug to your adult children or a ring to a friend. They're not able to take it. It's in a trust. And so a case in 1968, the Ninth Circuit decided was Crummy versus the commissioner, the tax commissioner, and that case was decided in favor of the taxpayer, Crummy, and what has resulted is what you know to be Crummy notices. And what that means is that you put your money into the trust account, you give your child the right to withdraw that or beneficiary the right to withdraw that, you give them notice. Frequently that's a written notice, more on that topic in a moment. But as long as they have the notice and the right to withdraw the assets for a period of time and their failure to do so, which is what we want, we don't want them to withdraw the money, then the money can remain in the trust and it can be used to pay the insurance, and it is deemed that we had made a gift with the present interest, like giving a ring to a loved one. Their desire not to wear it and to put it in a safe deposit box is still considered a valid gift. How much time do we want to give them to withdraw? It varies from firm to firm and strategy to strategy. Historically, the most conservative approach is 45 days. So what we like to see is that when you put your deposits into your accounts for your children or your loved ones, that you have a notice at that point that says you have 45 days to withdraw. We have gotten more sophisticated on these notices. We do things now like saying things such as there's been a gift made. We don't tell the beneficiary how much the gift is made for. We tell them if they have any further questions, they should notify our lawyers. Those are still valid notices of the gifts, and we're never depriving them of the information, but at least we make it more of a hurdle if the beneficiary wants to know more about the gift. It also gives the lawyers the opportunity to assess this person calling about the gift and find out exactly what their intentions are. You know, you'll give a gift only once in trust to your child, and if they withdraw that money or loved one, you won't give that gift again. So more on that topic about how we have flexibility if a beneficiary goes rogue. going forward, and also, by the way, you know, if you're giving gifts and you into a trust, last piece, and your trustee is your spouse, and your spouse is the guardian of your children, and the insurance proceeds are for the benefit of your spouse and your children, you can give notices to your children. You can give money into the trust for your children, but the we would argue you don't have to make a formal notice because the trustee knows you've made the money, the gift into the trust. She's your spouse, and your trustee is acting as the guardian for your children, who are minor children. Only when your children become adults is it necessary to give them a notice, as long as their guardian, here the mother, has full actual notice so that she can act on behalf of the kids. We've taken this strategy of putting money into trust as a way to get as much money off of our balance sheet each year to pay the insurance premiums, which the insurance then is a way to pay estate tax and to create further liquidity for your family many years down the road. And so this has worked wonderfully. If you have five kids, five times $14,000, husband and wife can make a joint gift. So that's $50,000, that's $90,000 worth of gifts you can use to pay insurance premiums, and they are not reducing your lifetime exemption. But what happens if you have a child that passes away? What happens if your insurance is more? What happens if you only have one child or two and your insurance premiums are $100,000? So a strategy came along where you can incorporate more beneficiaries than just the people who have who you immediately expect to benefit. So the IRS went after this as well in a case called Maria Cristofani, where she challenged the IRS's decision that her crummy gifts were not valid. Why? Because she gave notices to, or in that instance, the family gave notices to people who were what we call contingent beneficiaries. Contingent meaning that when you when you pass away, your children are your primary beneficiaries and your spouse, but if the whole family passed away, they're on a cruise ship and it, you know, tilted over, in that instance, the alternate beneficiaries would be the ones who would receive the insurance proceeds. So they were sending notices to these people, and the IRS came back to service, challenged that case, and said, look, these are not really legitimate gifts because these people don't really ever have the right. They would never reject taking the money. They would always take the money out. And if they don't take the money out, they're fools because they're never going to get the insurance proceeds. Get the money now. And the IRS challenged, this was put before the IRS, and the IRS says, we don't care. We don't care that they are not going to ever receive the money. We don't care necessarily that that they're in on the joke and that they know not to withdraw the money. The fact that they have the notice and the fact that they have failed to withdraw the money, even if it would seem unreasonable for them to fail to withdraw, is still sufficient enough. And so the IRS has said in those instances, do not that a beneficiary who is more remote, like a contingent beneficiary, would not be deprived of the trust would not be deemed and the gifts would not be deemed invalid. We have not taken such a conservative or such a liberal approach. We believe, and there have been some rumblings, that the IRS will scorch the earth and bring challenges on these cases, even if they know that they'll lose, as a way of chilling the estate planning strategists from doing this. So what we've said is, let's give these more remote beneficiaries a present interest by actually giving them what we call a thin linear slice. Maybe it's 1% or 2%. So if there's a $1 million trust, for easy math, and we pass away, 1% would go to nieces and nephews. You'd give them on 1%, it would be $10,000, and they could split it among themselves. The IRS, this does not then fall into the bucket where the IRS feels that they want to challenge those, even successfully or unsuccessfully, as immaterial, and we give these people notices. And again, you know, imagine your nieces and nephews saying, well, you know, so, you know, Uncle John has put money into a trust and given me the right to withdraw it. Well, we don't want to tell them how much the money is, and we want the parents or the family members to know that this is part of the strategy whose primary beneficiary is not the nieces and nephews, but really, you know, the children of the maker of the trust, but there will be some money at the end. we explain that. We don't get into the details in the notice. If the children want to know, these nieces and nephews want to know more, then they can call the law firm. The reason that we love this strategy, and it's one of our single favorite strategies with life insurance, is because we can pay, some clients will take $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 a year in insurance premiums and only have a couple of children. And the result is that they would have to use their $5 million lifetime exemption every year that they're putting this money into the trust if they have a $300,000 gift. So if we can create a large enough class of people that we can send crummy notices to, we're in great good shape because we're not using any of our $5 million exemption. We'll need that for other pieces. The other reason we like it is because our clients and we are huge fans, you guys, of making gifts to children each year in trust. So sometimes we have found that the children say, you know, Mom and Dad, you guys have done a great job of estate planning, but what can you do to help me now? Oh, I'm sorry, we were speaking with the life insurance agent, and he's taking care of you when we both pass away with a $5 million life policy, so your annual gifts are going there. That's phenomenal strategy, but it doesn't help the children now. So what we'll do is we'll create a class of beneficiaries beyond what the insurance premiums are, so that we do not need to include the children in the annual notices. So say there's a $100,000 premium, we'll come up with six beneficiaries other than the children, and so each of those six children is entitled to $14,000 from husband, $14,000 from wife, so that $60,000 there, and 6 times 4 is 24, we'll come up with more than that. We'll come up with 8, okay? So that's 80, and then 8 times 4 is 32, it's 110. And the children, then, we can make annual gifts to them in a separate trust that they can receive each year, and it's not being caught up in the life insurance trust. So big way for us to approach this. I cannot emphasize enough that we want to continue to use those strategies as we have. One very, very important concept that we won't touch too much on today, but in the future we will, is the generation skipping tax issue. Is that when we're making these gifts into the life insurance trust, we are not allowing these gifts to go generation skipping tax-free. They can go to your spouse and to your children or directly to your children, but if your children pass away, the portion of the life insurance proceeds that was attributable to the annual gifts will not go to your grandchildren free of tax. So the new laws have come along, and we'll talk about it in a couple of minutes, which have said, you know, we're going to automatically allocate these gifts to your generation skipping tax exemptions. I don't want you to spend time on that now because that automatic allocation has helped, you know, in less sophisticated estate plans with less sophisticated estate planners. For us, we don't want that automatic allocation. We don't want the IRS telling us that your premiums paid for your life insurance are going to go for generation skipping tax benefits. We would rather make the gifts that are generation skipping tax-free for other forms of trust, where we're putting their family house in a trust or partnership interest, where we know that that can grow and can remain in the family for many generations, and so we want that to pass free of tax. But with these lifetime gifts, you have to be very, very careful. It is the hottest, biggest issue that we're working on for our clients now. Number three, how can insurance be utilized to facilitate a business succession plan? So, there are several pieces here. When you're transferring a family or closely held business, we have to contemplate that not all the children will be interested or suited to take ownership of the business. I was with two wonderful gentlemen yesterday in the New York area who have a wonderful bakery, and they trace their roots all the way back to when Sinatra would send a black car to go pick up pastries in the 40s and 50s. The great news is, as a very tight Italian family, the two brothers' children, some of them, were going to take the business over. But what about the children that are not involved in the business? How do we square them up? And so a huge issue, and one of the major issues why I've in the estate planning industry as well is because I watched my grandfather pass the business, and without all the thought of how he's providing for the people who are receiving the business and how he's providing for the ones that are not, And imagine one or two of your children taking your business over, but being subject to huge resentment of the other family members who say, why should he get the business or she? They've gotten all the income for these years. They've gotten all the deductions. They've had a great life. They never had to start the way we have or my husband has. On the other hand, the business owner says, I've worked forever on this, and my siblings are all resenting this, and I need them to help me with loans because I'm struggling for cash flow. So life insurance is a phenomenal opportunity to help families like this, to provide liquidity, to square up the family members who are not going to get the business, to make them feel less resentful, to maybe allow for cash for the owner of the business. We had a client approximately 5 years ago who was, you know, the patriarch of a large cleaning business. He passed away, and the lenders shut down their business line of credit because they had no confidence that the successors could run the business or could keep preserve the line of credit. He was in huge stress of cash, and there was none around immediately, and it was heavy negotiations. Knowing that your children can get an injection of cash for uncontemplated, what I want to say is vicissitudes in the markets or negotiations, give them a sense of relief. They're already mourning your loss, and they're already stressing as to how life is going to be like post your passing. Having that injection of cash for the children who are going to get the business, having the other family members who are going to get other assets, not necessarily the business, at least takes away the resentment and the sadness that maybe little Johnny got treated better or Susie got treated better. So we are a huge fan of the insurance piece. As we move on to the next piece, what kinds of insurance are there? I'm going to give you more detail when I send you the updated memo on this. And for sure, I cannot emphasize enough that while there are three types that we typically see, your insurance professionals know this stuff better than we can ever articulate it. I will say, having my father in the business for 60 years and being around the best and the brightest in the insurance industry, because we collaborate with them every day for 25 years, we know a lot. But the final answers must always rest with the people who are living, eating, sleeping, and drinking this every day. So what we do like about second-to-die insurance, and this is an insurance policy on both husband and wife, is that it only pays out when the second spouse passes away, and as you all know, when the taxes due. So between a husband and wife, unless they're non-citizens, there is a tax that's due only, there's no tax between husband and wife, only when the children when the parents pass away. So the second-to-die insurance is designed strictly to inject wealth into the estate and to provide that liquidity. It often can be cheaper because the insurance company now only has to bet on one of you living to the age of 85, 90, 95, 100 today, 110, and so they can provide you better rates. If one person, however, of the two is uninsurable, then they're only working on the life expectancy of that individual that they know is healthy. So it may not make sense to buy second to die. You may be able to shop at another carrier who can give you a better rate on a single life. The gifts will go into the trust. The premiums are paid. And the check comes out when it's needed most. You can also look at term insurance, and I see a real need for term insurance. I always have this visual that term insurance is the young couple who lives in the city, who rents a house in the Hamptons or down the shore, and or up on the Cape, and they say, you know, listen, I'm only renting a car for the weekends because it's, you know, it's 8 weekends of the year. I need a car. The total cost of the renting is X, and I'm in good shape. That makes good sense. But at some point, the couple has their first child, or the couple decides to buy a house in the Hamptons, or the couple is traveling out 3 days a week and taking off Fridays, and the rental costs become too expensive. And so then they move forward and they decide to buy a car. And that would be what we would call permanent insurance, and often that's viewed as whole life insurance. The term insurance is a fixed fee for a fixed period of time. It serves a very important purpose, but there is no investing or cash that's built up. It's like your home insurance. You write the check at the end of the year. You thank God your house didn't burn down, and they send you a notice and say, you know, we'll start the next year. You can buy term insurance for 20 years or more. Whole life is a product that we are big fans of. Many of our clients, and there's been great articles on this topic, and in fact, I was on with a client this morning reviewing that, you know, the Wall Street industry has viewed permanent coverage, and particularly whole life, as a bit of a darling because they treat it as a bond portion of their diversified portfolio. They can get a guaranteed or close to guaranteed return with the top carriers. It is cash that they can access. Their policy is fixed. Their insurability is never at risk. Once they're insured, it's done. Rates don't necessarily climb, and they get a good return on their money. The Wall Street Journal's article talked about that the Wall Street industry even likes it so much that they use it beyond the amount of the death coverage. They don't even care about that as much as the yield they're getting on their life policy. And the Congress has sought to potentially claw that back because they said this was not the original intent. The life insurance industry and its lobbies, however, are so powerful that potentially taxing dividends or taxing insurance proceeds, I think, is a long, long way away. But we do feel that whole life insurance is clearly an incredibly valuable long-term play. Initially, people buy this insurance as an income replacement. If they pass away, their spouse has the income to live comfortably for many years. But then that evolves into a wealth replacement, and they say, well, I'm still alive. My wife is now, or my husband's fully taken care of. We'll use this insurance to pay the estate tax. Okay. Number five, how can ownership and beneficiary designations for life insurance policies affect the taxable estate? So given the unlimited marital deduction, there is no tax between husband and wife. And so you may see proceeds passing from husband to wife, and you may hear people say, well, insurance, as you all know because you're long past this, you know that insurance is tax-free. It is not tax-free. It is if you invest in whole life, the investing that takes place each year while you're still alive compounds tax-free or tax-deferred, effectively. Number two is if you name your spouse, there's no tax between husband and wife. But when your spouse passes away, then you find yourself in a position that the asset is taxed in your estate. Or if your spouse predeceases you, the asset is taxed in your estate. So it is critical to realize that while we love insurance, we tend, and we've been talking about this theme throughout this discussion, even as compared to the British, that insurance should be considered to be held in a trust. If you do not put the insurance into a trust when you purchased it originally, you will have a waiting period before that insurance will be included in your, will be excluded from your estate. Currently it's 3 years. As you know, President Obama has looked at many strategies which he believes are exclusively employed by the ultra affluent. Things like GRATs, where you're making loans to your kids, you know, middle class and lower class people are not using them. Taking discounts on large partnership interests, middle class and lower class are not using them. So these are strategies for the wealthy. And he could come along and say that the 3-year wait before you transfer your insurance into trust could be much longer. We don't know. It has not been brought up necessarily, but we do know that the time you put your insurance into trust, you have to wait 3 years if you did not purchase it directly inside the trust. There are strategies around that, and one of them is that the trust can purchase existing insurance either from another trust or outright from you. These strategies are more complex, but they do help avoid the 3-year wait. Ask me if we've ever had a client that's passed away before the 3-year period has evaporated. The answer is absolutely. And the good news was that it passed to his spouse, and so there was no tax to her. But the bad news is now she has that asset in her estate, and when she leaves us and goes to heaven, it will be taxable in her estate. We want the insurance, if particularly if they're meaningful amounts, off your balance sheet as soon as possible, because you will pay, with depending on the state you're in and the federal amounts, and wherever Obama goes in the future, he says in 2018 the rate he wants to be 45%. You'll pay that plus state if you're in the New York metropolitan area, just by example, although we have people all over the country, you will pay over 50% on that tax. So I cannot emphasize enough that we need to look ahead of time any new coverage to consider keeping that inside of a trust. Not the same if you're going to England, okay? But keep that in mind. The other piece that's critical is if you are non-citizens, your spouse will be subject to estate tax on anything over the absolute minimums. We can set up what we call qualified domestic trust to avoid the insurance, you know, the tax between husband and wife. But we're sad because at least then at that point, it's going to be taxed before it gets to the children. So what we can do here is put non-citizen beneficiaries have create a life insurance trust. The insurance goes from husband to non-citizen beneficiary wife, free of tax, and then down to the children, and you do not have the qualified domestic trust constraints, the pieces that you would otherwise have for non-citizens. We are big fans of doing that. What we are struggle with is when in a rush, and it's important because our beloved insurance relationships, their job is to protect husband and wife in the event that they pass away and have liquidity. And so sometimes they've heard, well, have husband-owned wife's policy and wife-owned husband's policy as a way to avoid the non-U.S. citizen issue. It does avoid that one immediate issue, but what it does do is it now has the insurance in the surviving spouse's name, and there's no, that asset now is subject to tax when they die. Creating the trust avoids that that problem altogether. Number six, how do citizens avoid qualified domestic trust requirements with a life insurance trust? As we've talked about, this is a very important strategy. The insurance for the non-citizen would be held inside the trust. It would provide to that non-citizen when the maker of the trust passes away and go down to the children free of tax. We're on to number seven. What are some of the strategies to avoid the three-year look-back? This is an important piece because when we transfer insurance into trust after we've already created it, it's not just a simple transfer. The IRS says, well, there could be $100,000 of cash that's built into that trust, and that effectively is a gift into the trust. And so we have, what is the gift actually? I normally refer to it, you know, in its street vernacular, which is the cash value, but there is a term in the industry called the interpolated reserve value, and that number is only achieved by speaking with directly with the insurance carrier, who can tell you in effect what the amount is, and that then is the gift when you're transferring it into the trust. We for sure can avoid that three-year look back that way. We can avoid the three-year look back if we have the trust have cash in it and actually buy the policy from us. A term policy is easy because there's no cash. Permanent policy is a little bit more complex, but for sure those things can take place. We're on to number eight. Annual exemption gifts can fund life insurance trust gift tax-free, but what about generation-skipping tax issues? We talked about that earlier in the call. So the issue here is when you make a gift into a trust, you have the opportunity to make that gift generation-skipping tax-free. You have an exemption that allows you to pass as much today, not just to your children, but all the way down to your grandchildren. You cannot, however, take a gift that is the annual exemption gift, the $14,000 annual exemption, and allocate that to generation-skipping tax-free trust. It impacts that significantly. So last year, for example, we had many of you doing a $5 million policies, you know, $5 million of gifts into a trust, some $3 million, some $2 million, whatever the amount is, to avoid this big pending tax we feared was coming. And now, in the new year, we have seen that, well, you've made, you know, 20 years of life insurance premiums into a trust, and since 1999, those gifts have automatically been allocated to generation-skipping tax credit. So now we have to go back and look all the way back to 1999, see what gifts you've made, and either reverse those out, some we can, some we can't, because this large $5 million gift or less now is now deprived of going all generation-skipping tax-free because we've used a portion of it for life insurance. We do not necessarily favor leading with having your life insurance generation skipping tax-free if you have large other assets that we think could grow. As I said earlier in the call, like your house, like your home, like your business, like your private equity investments, which you think can explode in value over the years to come. Life insurance serves a much different purpose, right? It is a steady, guaranteed return next week if you pass away. It has a wonderful investment inside of it. But whatever that amount is, the face amount, there is some growth over a 20-year period, but that's your number. And so if we can find other assets that will go generation skipping tax-free, we want to do that work. In some respects, what we're doing is an estate administration for you while you're still alive, so that we're avoiding that complexity and the possibility that the IRS is going to say that, no, this wonderful home you have is not generation skipping tax-free. No, this business of yours is not generation skipping tax-free. And why is that important? Well, we want to know that not only are we taking care of your children, that they're enjoying this, but that should they not spend these assets, should they continue to live and love the house on the coast in Cape Cod, we want to know that that can go down to their children free of tax. That's generation skipping tax. Number nine, when the terms of an irrevocable trust do not reflect the wishes of the parties, what options are available? For years, I think that practitioners in the industry said, you know, you're out of luck. We've never actually taken that approach. We do believe, though, that when you create a trust, you need to know, like the way you, when you walk down the wedding aisle, that this is once and only. We know that things come up afterwards that say maybe that isn't always the case. But a trust being irrevocable is irrevocable. Well, a handful of years ago, one strategy came up which was called decanting. And decanting is like decanting a bottle of wine. You take your wine, you open the top, you pour it into a whole new vessel that we can call a decanter. And while the wine has never touched the floor and maybe there is nominal evaporation, the fact is it looks, smells, and feels like something different inside the decanter. And so this clever name is used to say that we can replace the terms of the existing trust with a new trust by decanting. New York State, one of the few states in the nation that is not what we call these asset protection retreats like Delaware and others, actually allows for decanting. It's an irony because they will not allow you to have a trust in New York State for perpetuity. They have restrictions, but they will allow you to revise the trust. My smart colleagues in that are on several of the state planning committees that made the recommendations do have a method to their madness. When you decant, though, you can't just rewrite the trust in whatever terms you want. You have limitations on what kinds of things you can decant. The future vessel to hold the wine or the new trust has limitations. Sadly, for our benefit, as New York has become more sophisticated, their decanting statutes have become more restrictive. To their credit, as they've smartened up, but it means that we cannot just, for example, change the current beneficiaries on a trust by decanting in New York. There are other states that give us greater flexibility, but that means the trust has to be able to go to that state and transfer it. So our trust always allow for the change of jurisdiction. They allow the trustees and others to have the ability to do that. We can add on trustees, so if you go to Delaware and you want to call Delaware your home, you have to have a trustee in Delaware. The home of the trust is the home of the trustee, or at least one of them. And in Delaware and South Dakota and Nevada and Alaska and now Florida and New Hampshire, those are our top six, but our top four I listed in the order, in the top order, are places where you can move the trust and then decant, provided your trust allows for it, and make modifications. Each state has their varying pieces. The other way to change a trust is to make it is to allow the asset to be purchased out of the trust. So if I have an old trust that we refer to as old and cold, it's doing what it's supposed to, but their provisions we're not happy about. Maybe a special needs child came along the way. Maybe there is additional needs for a particular beneficiary or a beneficiary may not necessarily want on anymore for whatever reasons, incarceration or divorce that led to a big litigation. we can create a new trust and have the new trust purchase the old trust out for the interpolated reserve value amount, and then take the proceeds in the old trust and make distributions to current beneficiaries. The trust has to be drafted well enough that we have flexibility to make those distributions today. But the good news is the insurance is then into a new trust with new provisions that make you happier. Number 10, as we round the clubhouse turn, a little bit longer today, I apologize. How to use life insurance as a wealth replacement strategy with charitable giving. You all have known, and we've talked about this significantly. It is a significant part of what we're doing at the office as well through charitable planning, family mission planning. As you know, Dominic is working with me on these pieces as well. You can use charitable remainder trust, where you put assets into a trust. You receive an annuity over a series of years. You get a charitable deduction. At the end of that charity, that trust period, those assets pass to a charity. Well, there are a couple of things that go on here. That is the typical way, but we like to favor a couple of additional bells and whistles. Number one is we like the end charity to be a foundation created by you. So it will be the John and Rose Mary Family Foundation, and the remainder of the assets in this charitable trust now go to the charity, and that would be our foundation. We'll add my children on, our children on. They can serve as trustees. We'll make distributions annually as required by the trust and the foundation. And in the meantime, my children could say, well, that's great, Dad. You know, $1 million went into this foundation. We're making gifts. We love it. But, you know, how are we going to pay for our children's school and so forth now that that money is gone? So we'll use the annuity stream during the period of time that the trust, the charitable trust was in place to purchase current life insurance on Rose and my life so that the children know that there is this wealth replacement piece. A very, very important piece that we think is critical here. What we like about the value of having the wealth replaced is we never want the children to be resentful that the foundation or certain charities have received money when maybe they feel that they should have been, this was their birthright. And I can see that as a very reasonable point. It does mean that it's incumbent upon Rose and me to, and Dominic, who's leading this charge for us as a firm, to orient and to manage expectations of the heirs so that they know that a portion of what the estate is giving back. But the other piece here is that if there is insurance to help approximate or wholly equalize the children, that allows them to step into the position of making gifts to charity with a clear head that they're not stressing about their own personal finances. I sit on, as you guys know, boards, charitable boards, Dominic as well, and one of the issues was a large gift was made to a charity we're with and to pay for a significant capital improvement. And after the parents passed away, there was a big event at the, at the charitable organization, a ribbon cutting, talking about the work and the naming of this project, and other children attended. And we felt that there was this tremendous gift that was received in all goodwill, but then we had sadness by the children. So somewhere there was a disconnect. Maybe there wasn't insurance to replace this gift. Maybe the children were not informed and managed on this issue. But we really want to see that kind of great global giving continue and not have children put up breaks of resentment along the way. So to